You'll see that what I'm offering you is far more than you've had in the past. All that's required of you is to purchase a ticket to Auckland as many times in a year as you'd like to come, and to arrange a safe venue for them to stay with you at weekends when you're here. And I've given ground on allowing you to take them on holiday here as well. Not during their school term, but that's hardly unreasonable. Additionally, Sandra and I are happy to give over half of their summer holiday to you, again in Auckland, and not, naturally, on Christmas Day. But if you're here in Auckland on Christmas Day, we're happy to have you for lunch. And should you wish to be with the boys on their birthday or at Easter, there won't be a problem with that. We'll have to pound out how much time each visit would comprise, but this does not have to be the problem you're making it. "Oh, you're the bloody voice of reason, aren't you?" she said bitterly. "I'm trying to do what's best for everyone. Why do you hate me so much?" He fell silent for a moment, and then, in an altered voice, he said, "I don't hate you. You merely see it as hate. But your thinking has been distorted by drink for so many years. Isabel, do you want me to recount how many times I asked you to get help?" Her lips felt frozen. She could barely get the words out to say, "I deserve a relationship with my sons. They deserve a relationship with their mother. There's a bond between a mother and her children that can't be broken. They have a mother. I don't want to hurt you, Isabel, but don't you? What else is this supposed to be? You know it's the truth. Sandra has been a mother to them since they were less than 2 years old. You share a blood tie with them, but nothing more. That was the choice you made, to let everything save the blood tie go. If that's painful for you now, then all I can say is that this is something you might have considered when we divorced. I'm not to blame that you didn't." "You bastard!" She found it so difficult to speak that she wanted to rip the words from her own throat. "You'll never have done with punishing me, will you?" "You're punishing yourself. But only you know why. I haven't a clue."
"Is that Mummy? Is it Mummy?"
Isabel heard the words from the background and cried out.
"She lied to me! Let me talk to them!"
"You're not in any condition to talk to either of the boys. When you are, you can ring again. And if they're here, I'll let you speak to them both. I'm ringing off now, Isabel. We've the school run to do." She was left with her mobile in her hand and black silence coming out of it. Her nerves were screaming at her to do something. Her mind was doing much the same. Her heart was pounding and her palms itched so badly that she wanted to claw the flesh till all that was left was bones. She picked up the bottle of vodka. She saw how badly her hand was shaking. Her fury was demanding that she act. She knew that, while her options for acting were limited in this moment, a drink could at least stop the shaking and stop the terrible itching of her palms. But she put the bottle back on the bedside table. Staring at it, she counted the reasons. Want, need, desire, hunger, safety, stillness, peace, oblivion. She quaked for it. She yearned for it as if it were a lover whose touch could lift her away from herself. After the two phone calls she'd just endured, she deserved this as well as needed it. She didn't measure from the cap this time. She drank straight from the bottle. Ludlow, Shropshire. Isabel encountered Peace on Earth en route to breakfast. She was about to ask him to bring her a very large pot of coffee and one slice of toast when Barbara Havers popped out of the residence lounge, where she had apparently been lying in wait. She wore on her face an expression that Isabel could well have done without. Clearly she was champing at the bit. She said, "Gaff, a minute," and did not wait for a reply. She headed towards the hotel's front door and darted outside, casting a look over her shoulder that suggested she had something valuable to impart. Isabel saw nothing for it but to follow. Once outside, Havers led her towards the pavement. Across the street, a lone gardener was mowing the lawn that bordered the castle walls with a petrol-powered machine that sounded like a jet taking off. Isabel longed for her coffee. She noticed that, clutched to her chest, Havers had the folders from the IPCC and DIPAIA. She launched into conversation in a tone of undue excitement, beginning with the announcement that she had a report to make, and, she declared, one that suggested there was much more in Ludlow that wanted looking into. "Indeed," was Isabel's non-committal response. She hoped Havers's recitation would not take long. It was, apparently, a case of yes indeedio, for Havers went on to talk about what she deemed as crucial points of interest that she had uncovered during the night. Only one of the two CCTV cameras on the police station's exterior swiveled, she announced, while the other was in a fixed position. From reading the IPCC report another time, Havers had discovered that the Complaints Commission had taken note of this. She added that the IPCC had also reported that the non-swiveling camera, which was on the rear of the building, was not functional. This, apparently, was a monumental detail, because while the sergeant was on her way to play with the camera at the front of the station, a police car driven by PCSO Gary Ruddock had pulled into the car park at the rear.
"And this is important for some reason?" Isabel asked her.
The jet engine lawnmower was working on her head. It had begun to pound. She needed coffee. Apparently, this was important because of what the sergeant had witnessed. The PCSO and a young woman getting out of the car, having something of a stare down, and then getting back into the car, which, by the way, Ruddock had parked in the deepest shadows of the police station's car park. Havers added,
"Far as I know, there's only one reason why a bloke and a bird park in the dark and don't get out of the car, Gov."
"But they did get out. For 10 seconds. But then they were back in, and in is where they stayed. You ask me, on the night in question, that's what Gary Ruddock got up to once he fetched Ian Druitt to the station. A little feel-me-poke-me-whatever in the car park with his girlfriend. Only it wasn't filmed, because the camera back there doesn't work."
"Are you truly suggesting that Ruddock fetched Druitt to the station, left the station, went off for a young woman whom he also fetched to the station, had some sort of encounter with her in the patrol car, drove her back to wherever, and then returned to the station? How could anyone possibly be that stupid?"
This seemed to be what the sergeant was waiting for. She said,
"No, not quite. I don't think it happened that way."
With something of a flourish, she removed from one of the folders a detailed tourist map of the town. She beckoned Isabel to follow her over to a wall that separated the hotel car park from its garden, and handing over the folders, she unfolded the map and said,
"Look at this, Gov."
A rather useless imperative, since what else did she expect Isabel to do? She pointed to a spot and said that here, in this location, was the police station. Hardly startling news. Then she said,
"And look here next. There's a route anyone can take to get from the river up to the police station, Gov. It's more or less direct."
She showed it to Isabel. A curving thoroughfare called Weeping Cross Lane that took one north from Teamside to Lower Golderford Street, where the police station sat at the corner of Townsend Close. Now, Havers pointed out, if there were CCTV cameras anywhere along that route, Isabel stopped her with,
"This is getting wildly out of hand, Sergeant."
And when Havers merely looked at her blankly, Isabel went on,
"I have a feeling your next recommendation is going to be to have an actual search for those CCTV cameras, and if there are any, your next suggestion is going to be to have a look at all the recordings made on the night in question, should any be available all these months later."
"Why?"
"Because a young woman could have, Sergeant.
If a young woman is seen on film somewhere in Weeping Cross Lane, it can only suggest she was heading up from the river to meet Ruddock the night Druitt died. Surely you know as well as I that there's absolutely nothing to prove it. But there's something else, Gov."
Havers traded Isabel the map for the filing folders, and from one of them she took out a document that they'd found among Druitt's possessions. The list of names, addresses and phone numbers of everyone associated with the after-school children's club that Ian Druitt had established. One of the addresses was actually in Teamside. It belonged to someone called Finnegan Freeman.
"See?" Havers said. "The idea of an eager female slipping in from somewhere to meet Ruddock got me looking at the map to see how she could have managed it, and the fact that one of the routes she could have used came from Teamside got me looking at the list of kids in the club, because it sounded familiar. I mean the Teamside part of it. And there was the name and the address." "We're back to paedophilia, then?"
Isabel allowed herself to sound as weary as she felt.
"And this is our victim, whose parent crept up from the river—" "Oh, no, not our victim."
Havers indicated the list again and pointed out that Finnegan Freeman's name was the only one without parentheses following it, with those other parentheses containing the names of the parents of the boy or girl in question.
"When I spoke to Reverend Spencer, remember, he told me there was always an older kid who helped out at the club. I reckon this is him, this Finnegan Freeman, because no parents for him are on the list. That being the case, and considering that the IPCC looked only at the film from the night Druitt died, what else were they supposed to look at since he died at the station?" Isabel asked.
She was holding the map, and she saw that a tremor was in her hand. She was quick to drop the map to her side.
"They didn't look at what got recorded from the night of the anonymous phone call," Havers said. "If we examine things with that phone call in mind, It seems to me that we can reckon whoever made the call wanted Druitt arrested and questioned. We agreed on that, right?
Isabel made a somewhat royal "continue, please" gesture, a sort of rolling of her hand that Havers took as she intended it, for she plunged merrily on.
So why, if the person who made that phone call wanted him arrested in order to get him into the station in order to give him the chop? What if that person had done his homework and knew that on certain nights Ruddock had the evening off from caring for the old gent he lives with? And what old gent? Where the devil are you heading with this? The old gent isn't important, just a bloke Ruddock cares for in exchange for room and board and some cash. So what if someone knows that when he has some free time, which we can assume is on some kind of regular schedule, Ruddock takes his lady friend to the Nick's car park for a bonk? And what if this someone also knows the lady friend, our bonkie? What if the two of them cooked up a deal in which the someone waited for an arrest to be made of Druitt, post the anonymous phone call that this someone had already made, and when this occurred, the bonkie was sent to clear Ruddock out of the station in order to give the someone time to get to Druitt?
Isabel couldn't take her eyes off Havers, so convoluted did she find her scenario. She said, finally, "Sergeant," and then she breathed for a moment, in, out, and in, out, and in again, in order to say, "We can what-if this into next week. We can what-if this into next year."
"Right, I know, I understand. But the point is, Gov, that the IPCC didn't look into this part of things because the IPCC didn't know about Ruddock and his lady friend in the car park."
"Because," Isabel said, and she dug into her lack of resources for a patience she did not possess, "the IPCC were here to look into a suicide in the police station, and there was nothing in what they found, and there is nothing, and I mean absolutely nothing, that indicates this was a murder. That ought to tell you something, so why doesn't it?" Havers was silent, although the left side of her mouth jumped in such a way that she must have been biting her cheek. This, admittedly, was fairly admirable in someone who had never before seemed to believe that controlling herself was a requirement of her line of work. The sergeant looked towards the hotel as if waiting for confirmation of her ideas, perhaps from peace on earth. She looked to the castle, where, blessedly, the lawn mowing had ceased, and the gardener was, unfortunately, adding petrol to fire it up again. Then she said carefully,
"Due respect and all that, Gov. Sometimes, when there's nothing to be found as proof, it's because something's been missed, or something's there in order to hide what isn't there. You're attempting to make a point, so make it. It's like I said, the CCTV recording on the night of the phone call was never looked at, and no one's talked to this Finnegan kid who just happens to live nearby. I'm not saying either of these points mean anything, I'm just saying they could mean something, and they were overlooked. And isn't that why we're here, more or less?"
God, Isabel thought, they were never going to get out of Ludlow. They were going at this into eternity when she needed to be back in London, where she could fight Bob and Sandra properly. But she knew the maddening sergeant was right. She might have been bending the facts like the limbs of a Chinese contortionist, but the basic truth was the basic truth. No one had spoken to this Finnegan Freeman, and apparently no one had watched the film of the night of the anonymous phone call. She couldn't avoid the thought, then, of Clive Druitt and the threats he'd made about his team of solicitors. He and they were out there, somewhere, waiting for whatever report she and Havers came up with. To avoid a lawsuit and the kind of attendant rotten publicity that policing didn't need, she was going to have to make certain that every cobweb in every corner had been located, looked over and swept away. And the cobweb that had been the thickest from the first was the one declaring Druitt a paedophile. There was nothing for it. She had to agree. They were going to have to watch the film taken on the night of the phone call. They were also going to have to speak to Finnegan Freeman, but that did not turn out to be the worst of things. For Havers next picked up what Isabel had not earlier noted, Druitt's diary.
"There's this as well," she happily announced.
St. Julian's Well, Ludlow, Shropshire. Rabia Lomax had just stepped out of the shower when the phone began ringing. She decided to let it go to message and wrapped a bath towel round her. It was just the way she liked her bath towels, large, fluffy, warm from the towel rack and as white as the soul of a virgin. She was sinking into the blissful enjoyment of the Terry's embrace when she heard a woman's disembodied voice say, "Of the Metropolitan Police," which gave her pause to reconsider her plan of not answering the call. She went into the bedroom where the nearest phone was and said into it, "Metropolitan Police, is it?" assuming one of her fellow morning runners was having her on. Only today Rabia had been salivating over that scrumptiously delicious black actor whose unusual name she could never recall. He was at present starring in a gritty police drama, and this caller would be one of the runners setting her up as a result of that post-run conversation. So she said, "Do you work with that black bloke with the odd name? Could you send him along, as I've been the victim of a crime and I need him to comfort me?" The voice said, "I beg your pardon? This is Detective Chief Superintendent Isabel Ardrey of the Metropolitan Police. To whom am I speaking?"
Rabia reconsidered. The voice did sound official.
"We need to speak to you if your surname is Lomax," the woman went on.
Well, no one she knew would beat a dead horse, so Rabia said,
"What's this about? I assume your name is Lomax?" "Of course it is. What was your name?"
The woman repeated it. "Ardrey," she said. "Detective Chief Superintendent. Metropolitan Police. If Miss Lomax would remain at home, the police would be with her directly. Would that be convenient? Within the next 10 minutes?" A call from the police was hardly ever going to be convenient, but Rabia didn't see that she had a choice. So she said a half hour would be preferable if she'd just returned from a run and wished to shower. She'd need to dress afterwards and all the etceteras, so a half hour—no, let's make it an hour—would be sufficient. The Met officer said that would be fine and rang off directly she had Rabia's address. Naturally, Rabia didn't need that much time since she'd already showered, and she certainly didn't wear enough makeup to require more than 2 minutes at most to see to her face and another 30 seconds to comb her hair, most of that eaten up by trying to find a comb. But what she did need was time to phone her solicitor. She'd seen enough police dramas to understand the foolishness of ever talking to the coppers alone about anything without legal counsel. She went for her personal phone directory and punched in the number of Aeschylus Kong. Years ago, she'd chosen him to write her will purely because of his name. Who could possibly resist the temptation of meeting someone so interestingly monikered? She was put through to him as soon as she uttered, "Police are coming." In a moment she heard Aeschylus's reassuring tenor. It said, "Rabia, how good that you have phoned in this most curious situation. It pleases me that you understand the way of wisdom regarding the police and phoning one's solicitor." He always sounded like a combination of an 18th-century gentleman, Confucius, and a fortune cookie. "I shall be there as soon as I can manage. In the meantime, should they arrive in advance of me, do not speak with them at all."
"Shall I leave them on the doorstep or let them in the house?"
"The doorstep is preferable, but courtesy suggests entrance." Confucius, she thought. He went on with, "Entrance is safe, as long as they understand that you will not be having a conversation with them prior to my arrival."
"Won't that look suspicious?"
"Of course. But have you anything to hide from the police?"
"Aside from the body beneath the patio?"
Yes. "Well, if they come with shovels, do not allow them into the house." She also liked him because he knew when a joke was a joke. He told her he'd be there soon, and she went back to the bathroom to finish drying herself off. She ran a comb through her hair, vigorously rubbed her face with sunblock, as always, threw some colour onto her skin and went for something to wear. She generally wore tracksuits when she wasn't fancying herself up, and she wasn't about to fancy herself up for the police, so she chose her lime-green one and reached for her sandals. She was putting them on when she saw that the nail varnish on several of her toes was chipped. She muttered, "Oh, blast!" and went for the varnish remover. She absolutely loathed chipped varnish. She needed a pedicure, so she took a moment to ring her girl in Craven Arms for an appointment. Becky didn't like women wearing toenail varnish till June. She wanted everyone's nails to breathe from November onward, she claimed, although Rabia didn't think toenails needed to breathe at all. But Rabia didn't have time to argue with her on this subject, so she lied and said it was a manicure instead. They could have their toenail argument when she showed up. She was energetically removing the remains of the varnish when her doorbell rang. It rang two more times before she got to it, because it was out of the question that she would open it to the police only half-varnished and chipped at that. When she finally jerked the door open, it was to see a tall blonde reaching to have another go with the bell, while beside her stood a companion female who would barely have scraped 5'3" on a good day. They could have been anyone, Rabia thought, since they weren't wearing uniforms. But police detectives on the telly didn't, did they? So there was no reason to suppose these two would. The tall one said, "Miss Lomax, I'm Detective Chief Superintendent Isabel Ardrey," and presented her identification while she tilted her head towards her companion and said she was Barbara Havers, although Rebea did not catch her rank, since she was examining Ardra's ID, and trying to decide why the photo on it made her look 10 years older than she appeared to be in person. She handed the identification back to Ardra, and considered how she had jumped to a conclusion that was clearly anti-feminist. A woman had phoned, yes, but Rabia had expected her to be the inferior officer to a man, and this despite having in her possession every season of Prime Suspect on DVD. "Thank you for seeing us," Ardra said, and waited for what she obviously expected, an invitation inside the house. This made Rabia want to leave both of the detectives on her front step till Aeschylus arrived, but instead more than 6 decades of social breeding forced her to hold the door open and admit them. She led them into the sitting room, where she informed them that her solicitor was on his way. Both of the women looked surprised. She said, "It's the telly. I can never work out why they don't ask to ring their solicitors if the police want to speak with them." "Space things up if they don't," was the reply given by the shorter woman, Havers. "How?" Rabia asked in spite of herself. "Moves the drama right along. They can get to a confession or a clue or whatever sooner if there's no solicitor." Ardra said pleasantly to Rabia, "Have you a clue for us?" "Not when I don't know why you're here. I was heading to the kitchen. What appeals? Coffee, tea, mineral water, juice? It's grapefruit. I'm a victim to grapefruit in whatever form it comes, although I'm having a coffee just now. I've not had breakfast. I can forget that. But I must have my coffee." The superintendent said, "Ah, coffee takes more time, of course. Mineral water is fine for me." And the other woman agreed that mineral water was just the ticket for her as well. Rabia was assembling her tray of drinks when the doorbell sounded again. She went to admit Aeschylus Kong. He gave his usual formal greeting that was part bow from the waist and part handshake, his left hand over his right breast as if his heart had moved there during the night. He said, "Rabia, if only everyone were as wise as you." And she told him where he would find the coppers. She asked him if he wanted a coffee. He said a coffee would be splendid, black with one sugar. She returned to the kitchen as he joined the women from the Met. She could hear him introducing himself. The higher-ranking officer, Ardra, did the honours for their side. The other officer, Rabia overheard, was a detective sergeant. When Rabia returned to the sitting room with a tray of drinks, she saw that everyone was still standing, as if in anticipation of her arrival. Aeschylus was looking out at the back garden. The woman called Havers was flipping through a Roquette scrapbook, and Ardra was examining one of the photos from the mantle of the fireplace. Rabia couldn't see which one it was, but what she could see and did note was that the DCS handed it over to the other copper, who gave it a look, gave the DCS a look, then put the photo back on the fireplace mantle. When she did so, Rabia saw it was the photo of Volare Cantare, the consortium of pilots she was part of, standing in front of the glider they had purchased together. Considering the detective's interest, Rabia wondered if the glider constituted stolen property. When everyone had a coffee or mineral water, Aeschylus suggested that they all sit. He said to the police, "You have a wish to speak to my client, I understand," as he brushed his hand along his perfectly groomed head, as if it wanted his attention. "We are rather surprised that she felt she needed a solicitor," Ardra replied. "That would be upon my advice, which I would give to any client who rang me and told me the police wished to speak to them. You must not, as a result, presume her guilty of anything."
"We don't," Ardra said. "I merely find it odd that, not knowing what the subject of our call was going to be, she would phone her solicitor."
Aeschylus made a movement of his hands, opening them briefly in a gesture that looked rather welcoming. He said, "What is it that we can do for you?"
"Your client is the only Lomax in the phone directory. She's listed as R. Lomax."
"R for Rabia, yes," Aeschylus agreed. "Women should always use only their initials in any directory. On their bills as well. It's an issue of safety. Please go on, Superintendent."
Rabia saw the other woman, Havers, take a notebook out of her shoulder bag, along with a mechanical pencil. She was curious about why her words or those of Aeschylus Kong were going to be noted, but she didn't ask about it. If asking was going to be necessary, she had little doubt that her solicitor would do the job.
"Are you acquainted with Ian Druitt?" Ardra asked her.
Rabia glanced at Aeschylus, who nodded, so she said,
"He's the bloke who died at the police station a few months ago."
"Remember that, do you?"
Havers asked the question, looking up from her notebook.
"It was in the newspaper for days and on television news," Rabia said. "Were you acquainted with him?"
Ardra asked again.
"I'm not religious,"
So you know that he was a clergyman? Rabia was about to reply when Aeschylus touched her hand briefly and said, "The fact that he was a clergyman was also in the newspaper, Superintendent, and it was mentioned on regional news as well. I, too, who am also not religious nor a member of any congregation, know that he was a clergyman. All of that was made public knowledge at the time of the man's death." Of course, Audrey sounded not the least bothered by these revelations. But what was not made public was the contents of the man's diary. The name Lomax was in it. "Sergeant?" Havers said, with a glance at an earlier page in her notebook, 28th of January through 15th of March. 7 times. Rabia didn't reply at once. She tried to consider every ramification of speaking. Then she made her decision. "That would have been about a family matter. I didn't think of him as a clergyman because it wasn't as a clergyman that I met with him." "May I ask why you met with him?" Audrey asked.
"If you can explain the importance," Aeschylus said politely.
"The sergeant and I are here to follow up on 2 investigations into Mr. Druitt's death." Rabia liked the sound of this, even less than she'd liked the sound of the police claiming to have seen Lomax 7 times in the dead man's diary. She said, "To be frank, my 2 adult sons are substance abusers. One is in recovery and one is not. The one in recovery has been having a very bad time of it. His middle daughter died some 18 months ago after a long illness. My son isn't coping well at all, and I needed, actually, to talk to someone about it. Mr. Druitt was recommended to me." "Who did the recommending?" the DCS asked.
Rabia was silent. This was exactly what happened when one talked to the coppers and said anything beyond either yes or no. She needed to keep her replies as simple as possible. Outside the house, a cat howled suddenly, one of those disconcerting preludes to a fight. Another cat responded. What followed was a mercifully brief spat of combined shrieking as the animals went after each other. Rabia grimaced. She wondered if anyone would mind should she dart outside and shoo the felines off, but no one besides herself seemed to have noticed the noise.
"Miss Lomax?" the DCS said. "I'm trying to recall one of my square dancing group, I think. Or it could have been one of the people I train with."
"Train with?"
"I'm a runner."
"But you don't actually remember who it was.
Why don't you recall?"
They'd spoken at once, the detectives. Aeschylus stepped in.
"My client's memory is germane to very little, and certainly not to your purpose in coming to speak with her today. She has indicated why her surname appeared in Mr. Druitt's diary, and I can attest to the death of her granddaughter, although that, too, has nothing to do with any question about who suggested Mr. Druitt as a sympathetic ear."
"Fair enough," Audrey said in reply.
And then to Rabia,
"Where did you two meet when you had your conversations?"
Rabia saw that Aeschylus was about to intervene again, but she also saw that they could go round and round forever. So she said,
"That's easy enough to answer, Aeschylus,"
and then turned to the DCS and said,
"It rather depended upon our schedules, sometimes here, but more often in one café or another." "I'm not sure what you mean. The day and the time are always the same."
"What she means," Aeschylus interjected, "is that while the day and the time are always the same, the place would alter due to whatever else she or Mr. Druitt had on that day."
"Busy, are you?"
Havers was the one to ask the question.
"Quite,"
Rabia said.
"Doing what?"
Aeschylus stood.
He said, "Now we have gone entirely off topic. My client has explained why she met with Mr. Druitt, and if there is nothing more on that subject, I shall have to draw this meeting to a close. Do you mind if I do that, Rabia?"
Rabia did not. Audrey locked eyeballs with Aeschylus. It was one of those moments when one person wants the other person to know who's really in charge. Then she said to Rabia,
"I believe you've explained things sufficiently." And to her colleague, "Sergeant Havers, have you a card with you?"
A few moments of strained silence passed while the sergeant excavated in her lumpy bag. She found a holder for her business cards and handed one of them over to her superior, who then handed it with some ceremony to Aeschylus Kong. She said,
"If your client remembers anything pertinent from her sessions with Mr. Druitt, please ring my sergeant."
"What could possibly be pertinent?"
Rabia asked, before she could stop herself, although she did take the card from Aeschylus.
"I'll let you decide that,"
the DCS said. St. Julian's Well, Ludlow, Shropshire. The photo begged for an explanation. Barbara reckoned that the DCS would bring the matter up the nanosecond that Rabia Lomax closed her front door upon them. There was more going on here than met the eye, and Audrey had to know it. Barbara gave her a quick look as they walked to the car. When they reached it, and still Audrey hadn't said word one, Barbara took the plunge.
"What kind of a coincidence do we want to call the glider bit?"
Audrey clicked the vehicle's locking system and they got inside.
"The photograph?
I don't see calling it a coincidence at all." Barbara chewed on this, saying nothing more till they were retracing their route to the centre of Ludlow. Then,
"But it's too dead odd."
"We're not in London, Sergeant. The population's small. The fact that Nancy Scannell and Rabia Lomax are both in a photograph with a glider has no real significance. Or do you wish to make it significant?"
"It seems like something we need to take on board, as they both knew the dead bloke. I mean Rabia Lomax and Nancy Scannell."
"Nancy Scannell did not know the dead bloke. Nancy Scannell cut the dead bloke open. If there's an important element I'm missing here, I'm intrigued to hear it, because otherwise it seems to me that you're suggesting collusion on the part of Nancy Scannell, altering the facts as she saw them on the corpse, and Rabia Lomax, based on Rabia Lomax's appointments with Druitt."
"The IPCC report doesn't say a word about Lomax," Barbara said. "They missed the connection. So did D.I. Pyre. Her report doesn't mention it anywhere."
"Why would either report mention Lomax? They didn't have the diary, and even if they got their hands on it, there is no connection to be mentioned." Audrey's voice sounded edgy. The tone was a warning not to press this any further.
"Everyone was investigating a suicide while in custody, Sergeant. Full stop. Are you trying to build a case that Rabia Lomax, for reasons unknown, got into the police station along with, let us assume, Nancy Scannell? The two of them then subdued Ian Druitt, also for reasons unknown, then strung him up by means of a doorknob and left him to die? Apart from there being no apparent motive and absolutely no evidence, how would they have accomplished this? Perhaps they're the ones who planned the burglaries that kept the patrol officers occupied. Perhaps one of them disguised her voice, made the phone call about paedophilia, contacted the others when Druitt was brought in, fed the PCSO a convenient sleeping draught obtained from the local crone practising witchcraft, and the rest is what happened after the PCSO downed it and passed out, allowing them to commit murder."
"He wouldn't have wanted anyone to know."
"There's that," Barbara said. "Ruddock could have let someone in that night, and that person could have done the deed while he was conveniently out of the room making his pub phone calls.
So now it's collusion on the part of Rabia Lomax, Nancy Scannell, and the town's PCSO? All of this coming from a random photograph of a group of people grinning round a glider?" Barbara heard the DCS's frustration, and she wanted to explain herself. She wanted to tell her that she and Linley had always operated on the basis of anything being possible. Nothing was ever too outrageous to consider, because the outrageous was always within reason when it came to murder. So was the unlikely. So was the unthinkable. So was the putatively inexplicable. Linley was the fine cop he was because nothing was ever off the table. He had never been the kind of bloke whose priority was making an arrest so that he could go home to supper. It was looking more and more, though, as if Isabel Audrey might be. Only, it wasn't going home to supper that she had on her mind. It was going home to something else. Barbara had already seen that. She could, even now, practically breathe it in with the air.
"And by the way," Audrey continued, "are you now eschewing your previous theory about the PCSO, the woman he's bonking and someone sneaking into the police station while said bonking is going on?"
"Gov," Haver said,
"it's just that really, Sergeant, this can't go on. I'm willing to speak with this Finnegan Freeman, whoever the hell he is, but that's it. I've gone along with the issues you've raised, but this is as far as I'm going to go."
Barbara said,
"It's only that when you showed me that photo, I thought, may I remind you that it was your thinking that put you where you are today?"
Audrey snapped. Barbara knew where that remark was going to lead. She liked to believe that she also knew when it was time either to change direction or to reverse course altogether. So she said,
"I suppose I might be looking at things wrong way round."
Although she didn't believe this for a moment.
"I'm glad to hear that," Audrey said. "There's still that anonymous call, though."
Audrey gave her a glare.
"Your point being, if we want to make sure this bloke, Clive Druitt, is satisfied that we've looked at every possible angle, it's probably time to look at the CCTV footage on the phone call night."
And before Audrey could respond, Barbara added,
"I could do that while you talk to Finnegan Freeman, Guff. How long would that take? Less than an hour, you ask me.
and then we would have touched on every possible item that might send Clive Druitt running to his solicitors.
Audrey squeezed her temples. She had a look of a woman whose internal resources were being quickly depleted. She said,
"Point taken. The CCTV film from the phone call night, full stop. And I hope you take my meaning, Sergeant."
Barbara assured her that she did. Ludlow, Shropshire. When she rang the PCSO's mobile about the CCTV footage in question, Barbara found that Gary Ruddock had not yet begun his official day. Old Rob had taken a fall, he told her, and he was just returning to Ludlow from accident and emergency. He reckoned he could meet her at the police station in 45 minutes. That was perfect, as far as Barbara was concerned. There was a small detail she'd not mentioned to Audrey that she wished to check out. To her way of thinking, which admittedly meant overlooking the DCS's way of thinking, if someone had given Ian Druitt the heave-ho into eternity, then that person was either the PCSO for reasons yet unknown, or it was a person, also yet unknown, who gained access to the station while the PCSO was engaged in something else. In this scenario, Barbara believed that the something else involved a car and a female. And she also believed that there had to be a way to prove this. So she set off for the station. She went with the idea of someone, be it Ruddock's lady friend showing up for a bit of clothing removal in the back of a car, or a killer with strangulation on his mind, gaining access to the police station via the route she'd pointed out to Audrey earlier. When she reached the station, she walked past it and along the street a short distance into Weeping Cross Lane. There she paced slowly along, looking for the kinds of CCTV cameras that were ubiquitous in London. This was a commercial area of town, with businesses serving many interests, from van hire firms to equestrian needs. At least 8 of them had CCTV cameras, Barbara found, which piqued her interest until she got close enough to see that not a single camera was pointed towards the street. That meant there was no joy to be had. But it also meant that anyone could come up from the river to the police station without being photographed along the way. She proceeded to the end of Weeping Cross Lane and found herself in Teamside. Since the to-be-questioned Finnegan Freeman lived in one of the houses here, Barbara thought it might serve her purposes to sort out which one it was. She checked the address in her notes and headed in the direction of the Ludford Bridge. As she did so, she caught sight of Audrey's car pulling up onto the pavement in front of a house at the end of a terrace called Clifton Villas. Barbara hesitated. She knew that Audrey didn't expect to see her in Teamside, so she gave thought to doing a rapid about-face and scurrying back into Weeping Cross Lane, where she could find a wheelie bin to hide behind if necessary. But she needn't have worried. The DCS didn't get out of her car at once. Although she was facing Barbara from where she'd parked, she rested her head on the steering wheel for about a minute before she finally shoved the car door open. She ran her hand over her hair, looked at her wristwatch, and proceeded to the front door of the house. She was out of Barbara's sight at that point, as the house appeared to have a shallow porch. For her part, Barbara made tracks back to the police station, where she sat on the back step and wondered about all that she was witnessing in the DCS, that she would have vastly preferred not to witness at all. There had been something not right with Audrey earlier. It wasn't just that Barbara had waylaid her before she'd had a chance to eat her breakfast. She had a feeling from her colourless complexion that Audrey wouldn't have been able to hold down food anyway. Nor was it the fact that the DCS had not been able to have her morning coffee prior to their conversation. Instead, it was what her right hand did when she took the map Barbara handed to her. It was how she dropped that right hand to her side when she couldn't stop its trembling. Barbara had concluded that the DCS was in a condition that might prevent her from noting a detail that needed noting. But she, Barbara Havers, wasn't in a position to point this out to anyone. Some 10 minutes after Barbara's return to the station, the PCSO drove into the car park. He gave her a friendly wave and strode to unlock the back door. She joined him, telling him about the movability of the camera in the front of the station as she followed him inside. She ended with, "So what I'm hoping is that it was in a different position the night the 999 phone call was made." This was only partially true. She had more on her mind than the 999 call. She led them in this direction by saying, "How's old Rob doing?" "He was talking about having a fry-up when I left him. He only gets them once a week, and his fall this morning prevented that. He was thinking I might do the honours, but there he got it wrong, poor bloke." Ruddock led her along the corridor towards the front of the station. the overhead lights shedding their usual unappealing glare upon the lino and, she reckoned, upon her unwashed hair. She said, "Sounds like you're quite fond of him."
"Can't help liking a bloke his age who's still got so much life in him," Ruddock said.
"On the other hand," she pointed out, "living with a pensioner must get in the way sometimes."
"How do you mean?"
He shoved open the door to the reception cubicle where once someone had sat to greet both visitors and individuals wanting police help. It was a small area, barely large enough to contain both of them. A desk to one side of it held on its top an out-of-date computer terminal. Ruddock switched it on and waited while it groaned into action. Barbara said,
"Your love life and all that."
"Eh?"
He turned back to her.
"Just thinking that it must make things rough, living with an old bloke like you do, if you want private time with someone."
He laughed, saying, "If I had a love life. With my wages, it's better not to. I suppose I could offer a lady a lager and a pizza on payday, but that's about it. That being the case, I keep them more or less at arm's length. The ladies, I mean."
Barbara listed this under the heading "Interesting Factoid" in her mind. She wasn't sure what to make of it. Behind him, the monitor came to life, and within a few keystrokes, there was a split screen to view. One half of it was black.
"Looks like that CCTV camera in the back isn't working, just like I thought," he said,
and the other showed a slice of the street in front of the station, the steps leading up from the pavement, and a portion of the path leading to the door. Ruddock went at the keyboard, and images flashed on the screen. What they took in remained the same with respect to the camera's position, although they documented a partial view of activities on the street as they flashed by. Cars passing, mums pushing prams and pushchairs, joggers, and two different individuals coming up the steps towards the path, and, one assumed, discovering that the station was unmanned. Then he stopped the images, and they were at the night in question, for it turned out that the call had been made at night. Hardly a surprise when one considered that it was anonymous, and there was nothing recorded save the night itself and the time, which was shortly after midnight. The image was what it had been from the start, a slice of street, the pavement, the steps, and part of the path to the door. Barbara hadn't actually expected to see someone wearing a Hannibal Lecter mask as he or she gazed up at the camera before swivelling it away from a position taking in the front door. There was something else she'd come to check. She asked Ruddock to continue going back through time, which he did. Finally, the image altered, and the camera showed the area immediately round the front door. When she asked him to advance the image forward slowly through time, in the direction of the night Druitt died, she was able to capture a moment when the screen went to black. When it brightened to picture again, the camera documented what it had shown ever since the call had been made, which was not the front door, but rather the route to get to it. Prior to the black screen, however, no matter how far back they went in the film, the focus of the camera remained on the door, which meant it also remained on the intercom. She asked Ruddock how much time had elapsed between the alteration of the camera's position and the anonymous phone call. He examined the images connected to both, and he told her 6 days. She said,
"So our boy, or girl, for that matter, knew that the camera swiveled and did the job days in advance. That way anyone, like me, looking at the images from the phone call night would think the camera had always been looking out towards the street and not at the door where the intercom is."
She pointed to the image, frozen on the screen.
"Shimmy along the station's wall once the camera's been moved to take in the steps up from the pavement, and you're not on camera at all."
"But you would be filmed moving the camera's position whenever you moved it," he pointed out. "Unless..."
Obviously the bloke was no dummy. He'd twigged that whoever had moved the camera had to have done it when it was completely non-functional. The only way to make it so was from inside the station, and it had to have been done quickly because the lapse during which the image was black had to be virtually unnoticeable were someone skimming back through the images to see if someone had been caught on camera making the anonymous call. Anyone doing the skimming would have seen that on the night of the phone call, the camera was documenting the approach to the station from the pavement. It was only by going back 6 days in the images that one could see the camera's original position in addition to the moment of no image at all, during which that position had been altered. Ruddock's consternation was playing out on his face. Barbara said,
"This call to 999 about Druitt, it could have been made from anywhere, you know, and still have been anonymous. Someone wouldn't want to use their home phone or their mobile, of course, but a call box somewhere."
"Providing there was no CCTV nearby."
"That would be no problemo."
"So why use the intercom?" he asked.
The whole bit with moving the camera. Why go to the trouble? She examined him. He examined her. It took only a moment. "'Cause it needed to be made from the station," he murmured. "That was the only sure way to make me look guilty."
"Just that, yeah. So what's your enemy list look like, Gary?"
"Jesus. I didn't think I had one."
She thought about what she'd seen of his use of the car park at night, and she also considered asking him about the lady he was with back there. But she decided to hold that on another burner of the cooktop, and instead she said, "In my experience, everyone has at least one." He turned back to the image and studied it. Then he glanced at her.
"But why not make the phone call straight away once the camera was moved? Or why not move it back into position at some point?
Could be the mover got interrupted and didn't have time then. Could be after moving it, he wanted to make sure that a few days passed so that someone checking the film would think, without looking back far enough, that the camera had always been in the position it was in the night the phone call was made. Could also be the usual one, though."
"What's that, then?" he asked her. She shrugged.
"No one thinks of everything when it comes to a crime."
Ludlow, Shropshire. When Isabel first saw Finnegan Freeman, she hoped that he didn't represent what she had to look forward to as a mother of two boys, regardless of who had custody of them. He wore his hair in a style that featured dreadlocks on the right and a shaved skull on the left. This latter allowed the display of a disturbing tattoo showing a wild-looking woman screaming, complete with uvula displayed as well as overlong canines, one of which dripped blood. The rest of Finnegan wasn't a picture either. His clothes weren't entirely objectionable, although they favoured excessively tattered jeans and an extremely threadbare flannel shirt. He wore sandals, perhaps in a bow to the spring weather, but his black, painted toenails did not delight. On his right ankle was a piece of braided leather, and a bulbous knot of the same material formed an earring that looked like an excrescence on his left lobe. He actually might not have been a bad-looking young man, but taken as a whole he was something that might have been created by Monk. She'd found him in what went for the sitting room of a house in Teamside. It sat at the end of a terrace of Edwardian vintage, if the tiles decorating the front porch were anything to go by. They featured sunflowers backed by dark green, a colour repeated on the front door of the establishment. The tiles had somehow remained in good condition. The same could not have been said of the door, which had been bashed repeatedly, possibly by careless removal men, and to which various transfers had been applied over time, most having apparently been placed by a fan of the Wizard of Oz in general, and the Flying Monkeys in particular. Isabel had gained entrance to the house by helping herself to the doorknob upon a shout from within of, "It's unlocked, whoever you are!" She found the owner of the shout in the sitting room. He was entertaining himself with a graphic novel while dining on what seemed to be a burrito, and he was doing so hunched over a coffee table of uncertain vintage and seated on a long chintz-covered sofa that looked to have come from someone's great-grandmother's attic. The rest of the room's furniture consisted of three overlarge beanbags, one ladder-back chair, a floor lamp, a television, and a three-bar electric fire, the flex of which suggested real fire was imminent should it ever be used. It hadn't been if the fireplace tools and the blackened condition of the small fireplace itself and its surrounding wall were anything to go by. A large sign on the mantel forbade the fireplace's use, but that had obviously been a small matter easily ignored by the house's inhabitants. Finnegan Freeman had made it clear that indeed he was Finnegan Freeman when Isabel inquired as to that person's whereabouts. He'd said, "Who wants to know and why?" And when she'd told him that the who of it was New Scotland Yard and the why of it was Ian Druitt, he was more than happy to say, "It's me, then," and he added, "My mum rang you, didn't she?" Isabel said, "Why would your mother be ringing New Scotland Yard? She's waiting for me to be enough out of order so she can drag me back home." "Are you frequently out of order, then?" He grinned and took in an enormous mouthful of burrito. He said, while masticating, "She hates me having fun. It's just how she is." Isabel reassured him that his mother hadn't rung New Scotland Yard, and that even had she done so, it wasn't within the purview of the Metropolitan Police to chase down misbehaving young people at the request of their parents. He said, "Not misbehaving, just having a bit of fun. She calls it me being defiant. Ha! I could show her defiance, I could, but she'd probably have a stroke."
"I see. Isabel told him then that Ian Druitt's death in the police station was what had brought her and another detective from the Met to Fair Ludlow to engage in a look-see at the conclusions that had been arrived at by the Independent Police Complaints Commission. At this, the young man set his burrito on the kitchen towel he'd been using as a plate. He eyed her as if measuring the level of her sincerity. Isabel had the odd sensation of being evaluated by someone who was quite a bit more than his appearance and manner of speech indicated. He said, "What have I got to do with that, then?" "We found your name amongst his belongings. It heads the list of members of a children's club here in town. As yours was the only name without what appeared to be the accompanying names of parents, we assumed you were the young man who assisted Mr. Druitt." "Quite a gumshoe, eh?" he said. "So you did assist him. What did that consist of?" Finnegan seemed, at that moment, to remember something vaguely resembling manners, for he slid along the sofa, patted one of its numerous lumps, and said, "Bark it if you want," by which she assumed he was extending an invitation for her to sit. She did so, although the proximity to him brought with it an attendant odour of dirty socks, which was rather odd, as he wasn't wearing any. She waited for illumination on the topic of what he did for Druitt's club. He said, "I helped them with their school prep. I helped out with equipment for sport. I showed them how to use the internet for school projects and the like. We did country walks sometimes, and I gave demonstrations."
"Demonstrations?"
Isabel hoped his demonstrations did not touch upon personal grooming or the world of fashion. He held up his hands. They were, she saw, oddly small for someone his size. He said, "Karate. Kids always love that stuff."
"That makes you quite strong, I assume," Isabel noted.
He shot her a look that said he knew where she was heading. "No crime being strong, far as I know."
"Of course," Isabel agreed.
She shifted to Druitt, asking Finnegan's assessment of him. What was he like, she wanted to know.
"That's easy enough," Finnegan replied. "What he wasn't like was a bloke who killed himself, which is what I've been saying to anyone who'll listen. Only no one's been interested in my opinion."
"That's why I'm here, Finnegan."
"Finn,"
he told her.
"Sorry, Finn.
I've come to hear your opinion."
"Why?"
"Because you worked with him at the children's club. You want to know, did he mess about the young ones? That's what this is. You want to know, did he plaster himself because he was going to get grilled about that?"
"I want to know whatever you care to tell me.
Your opinion will be welcome on any matter related to Mr. Druitt."
"You sound like my mum."
"I have children of my own. Mother speak gets into the blood. Do you have an opinion about Mr. Druitt?"
"I do," he said. "This is it. He was a good bloke. He cared about every one of those kids in the club. Most of that lot, they got sent there for what he could do for them, which was, let me tell you, buckets more than their parents were doing. I never saw him, not once, mind, do a single thing to any little kid, except maybe, and I'm only saying maybe, since I never saw anything, and it's not like I remember even this, except maybe giving a little one a pat on the shoulder or the head or the like. Other than that, he didn't do a single thing. He was just nice to him. He was great."
She said, "I understand."
He huffed.
"Good," she went on with. "But child molestation is a process of seduction that generally unfolds over time. A child is groomed by his molester, positioning him to accept the molestation as part of the relationship." Finnegan had reached for his burrito during his recitation, but now he threw it onto the kitchen towel with enough force that the towel slid across the coffee table and dumped the burrito onto the fitted carpet. This looked like something that hadn't been hoovered in a generation or two, so the resulting splat of beans, cheese and whatever was of little matter. He said,
"Did you even hear me?"
"I did, of course. But Finnegan, a man—"
"Finn!" he cried. "It's Finn, Finn, Finn!"
"Yes, sorry. Finn. A man gets away with acts of abuse or molestation because he seems exactly as Mr. Druitt has been described. Gentle, caring, committed, and all the rest. If he doesn't seem like that to prospective victims and their families, even to his mates, then he would never get on as an active paedophile in the first place. But I expect you know all this."
"What I know," he said, "is that he never stepped out of order with any of those little kids. They would have come to me if he did."
"And what about you?" she asked him. He went instantly red.
"I was never out of order with those kids. Are you accusing me of—"
"Sorry, no.
Isabel said, although she did wonder what Sergeant Havers might have dragged out of her Linley-inspired Shakespearean knowledge to address the young man's reaction, not to mention his occasional lapse into some interesting form of guess-my-social-class lingo, as if he couldn't quite decide from which stratum of society he had sprung. "I was asking if Mr. Druitt was ever out of order with you." If anything, Finnegan became redder still. "You listen if you can. He went out of his way to be nice to everyone, especially the kids who were bullied. He knew what it was like, and he taught kids that bullies are people who need to feel big, and the only way to stop their bullying is to take them on, with words or with fists, whatever it takes." "Is that why you learned karate?" "My dad put me onto it. I was bullied, yeah. But first time I showed what I could do, that put an end to that. And doing stuff to a kid like you're accusing Ian of doing, it's just another way to bully, and Ian didn't bully. He knew what it was like." "So he was bullied," Isabel said. "Or do you mean that he was sexually abused as a child? Did he reveal that to you?"
"No way!"
Finnegan fairly shrieked the words. "Which," she said, "the revelation to you or the sexual abuse?"
"Both! And if you think he was, and if you think he passed it on to the little ones, just ask them. You ask every one of them. You'll see that there's nothing in it, that he supposedly messed with little kids."
When he paused for breath, the noise of someone clomping down the stairs sounded. A girl appeared in the doorway to the sitting room. She said,
"Hey, Finn, I'm off to—"
and then stopped at the sight of Isabel. She switched to,
"Sorry, I didn't know anyone else was here."
Isabel found that difficult to believe, since Finnegan's voice had been raised to a volume that couldn't have gone unnoticed. The rooms of the house were hardly soundproof. The girl stepped into the room as if courteously waiting for an introduction. She was a college girl in appearance, with long hair that looked professionally streaked with blonde, petite but possessing a womanly body. She said,
"I'm Dina Donaldson, but everyone calls me Ding."
Finnegan said, "Mind you be careful who you're introducing yourself to. This is a copper, all the way from Scotland Yard, to wring the truth out of me." Ding took in Isabel much the way that Isabel had taken her in. She said,
"But you don't wear a uniform,"
as if this were a critical detail. "She's a detective," Finnegan told her. "You watch telly, right? They don't wear uniforms on telly. She's here about Ian."
"Mr. Druitt?"
"Any other Ian a copper might want to talk to me about? You got a bit thick. Drink too much last night?" The girl didn't reply to this. Instead, she shrugged out of her rucksack and she placed it on the floor. She was wearing a bright fuchsia skirt that she smoothed in a gesture that might have been nervous, or might have been intended to be read as nervous, and she adjusted the scarf that she'd fashioned as a cummerbund. Its tight print of clouds and flowers picked up the colour of the skirt along with the grey of her T-shirt. Isabel said,
"Did you know Mr. Druitt?"
The girl looked startled. Her gaze darted from Finnegan to the fireplace to Isabel.
"How?"
she asked.
"How would you have known him?"
Isabel clarified.
"Or in what manner did you know him?" I don't exactly... If you mean..."
"For Christ's sake, Ding, spit it out." Finnegan sounded like someone who knew the girl was buying time.
"I only heard about him," she told Isabel, "from Finn, mostly." "Who else?"
"Do you mean who else did I know?"
"No."
Isabel found that once again her head had begun to pound. She was going to have to do something about it. Soon.
"You said Finn, mostly.
In reference to hearing about Mr. Druitt, from whom else did you hear about him?"
"Oh!"
Ding crossed her arms beneath her breasts, a movement that made them more prominent. It had always left Isabel incredulous when women did this sort of thing, suggesting that they'd made no progress at all as a sex. Flash some grapefruit and one ruled the world.
"I expect it was all from Finn. I don't think Brutus knew him."
"Brutus?" Isabel said. "Is he someone who lives here as well?"
"Bruce Castle," Ding said. "Everyone calls him Brutus. It's, well, sort of a joke."
"'Cause he's a half-pint," Finnegan said shortly.
"Like a boy?"
Isabel asked.
"I mean, in size. Is he more like a boy?"
Finnegan took clear exception to this.
"Ian didn't do nothing to anyone here or anywhere,"
he declared hotly at the same moment as Ding said.
"Brutus wouldn't have done. I mean, he wouldn't have let anyone mess him about, if that's what you're thinking."
You know about the accusation of paedophilia, do you?
Yes, well, yes.
Ding sent a nervous glance in Finnegan's direction.
Everyone knows. I think Finn told me. Or maybe I heard Finn going at it on the phone with his mum. Maybe that was it. Is that it, Finn? Would that be how I found out? Or did I read it somewhere?
How if I know? All of a sudden Finn sounded bored, perhaps determinedly so.
Do you overhear a great deal in this house?
Isabel asked the girl.